You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, June 25th, 2018. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, executive editor of Viewpoint magazine and author of Mistaken Identity, Race and Class in the Age of Trump, Assad Haider. Meanwhile, more than 2,000 children remain separated from their parents. But the real travesty? Sarah Sanders can't get a table at her favorite restaurant. And as Trump claims to have gutted the ACA, Republicans fear the coming massive ACA premium spikes. Meanwhile, Mad Dog Mattis in the Mad Dog House. Secretary of Defense wasn't even briefed on our new Space Force. And Trump's MAGA mishap. Sorry, Harley. Global warming apparently still exists, ladies and gentlemen. SCOTUS punts on the North Carolina gerrymander case. And remember that whole peace with North Korea thing? That seems to be off again. And lastly, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation says, sorry for the education reform movement. So sorry. All that and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. I want to get to that story about the Gates Foundation. It will receive virtually no attention in really anywhere, for that matter, about, I guess maybe it was the end of 2017, the Gates Foundation said that they were going to change direction in terms of where they're going to be sinking their money. We now know why, and we'll talk about that later. But it has a lot of implications in terms of what I hope is now more or less dead. I mean, not the remnants are still here, but that so-called education reform movement, the corporatizing of our education, is hopefully over. But speaking of corporations, hey, do you guys remember way back in February of 2017? We were going to MAGA. We were all so excited about MAGA, right? We're going to make America great again by dealing with you know, some of its greatest companies and some of the steelworkers and all this. Let's go back in time, shall we, to February of 2017. And this is Donald Trump, the relatively newly minted president. Well, I guess he was he was newly minted at a meeting with a bunch of American businesses and some, I think, unions, in fact.
Wherever I go, whenever there's a motorcycle group, oftentimes it's a Harley, and the sound of that Harley is a little different, I have to tell you. It's really good. So thank you, Harley Davidson, for building things in America. I think you're going to even expand. I know your business is now doing very well, and there's a lot of spirit right now in the country that you weren't having so much in the last number of months that you have right now. You see what's happening. I'm especially honored to welcome the steelworkers and the machinists to the White House. Who's a steelworker here? You're all steelworkers, essentially, right?
Yeah, that's good. So thank you for building in America. I know that's going to expand because of the spirit that is in this country now that wasn't here a couple of months ago when, you know, the black guy was still president. Fun to look back on that moment as today, as the Financial Times reports that Harley Davidson said it will shift production of the of its EU-bound motorcycles away from its U.S.-based manufacturing sites as a result of Brussels' decision to retaliate in kind against Washington's tariffs on imported steel and aluminum. The famed maker of motorcycles said the financial impact of the EU tariffs would be up to $100 million per year. That makes the Milwaukee-based manufacturer one of the first U.S. companies to detail the financial impact of the escalating trade tensions between Washington and its allies.
It's going to be a piece of cake.
They're going to be easy. Also follows hard on the heels of Daimler, which you may remember as Chrysler, which last week issued a warning that its profits would be hit by new Chinese tariffs on U.S. imports. Harley-Davidson believes the tremendous cost increase if passed on to its dealers and retail customers would have an immediate and lasting detrimental impact to its businesses in the region, reducing customer access to Harley-Davidson products, et cetera, the group said in a filing on Monday morning. So much for the tariffs. Not to mention, those same steelworkers now are probably complaining about the tariffs as well, because it's not necessarily protecting their jobs. It is simply making downstream work with these products more expensive. MAGA.
Making deals left and right.
I'm making deals all over the place. Folks, I know because you listen to this program, you like being up on what's going on, right? So when I'm not listening to podcasts, which actually, to be honest with you, I don't do that often. I go through stages. But particularly when I have a little bit of downtime, I'm reading magazines, and I do it on my Texture app. As you know, I have a soft spot for Family Handyman, but I also catch up on my Wired, my New Yorker, sometimes Sports Illustrated, all of it available on Texture and more. Texture is the magazine app. It offers more than 200 of the best magazines all in one place, all at one time. You get complete issues, you get back issues, anytime, anywhere, all in one app. Stay connected to the biggest and best stories today with Texture. As you know, I've talked about Texture many times. When I travel, that's basically what I do. That's the way I catch up on my magazines. I create my own magazines so I can learn about how, you know, the best way to do trim work, Family Handyman, and then read a New Yorker article. Shop tips.
You gotta have the shop. It'd be an interesting magazine if it was a physical one curated like that. Just some political politics and some...
Yeah, I suppose you could hire somebody to glue it all together for you. But unlikely. Here's the deal. You can start a 7-day free trial by going to texture.com/majority. Why wait to start reading the latest issues of your favorite magazines? Try Texture for free at texture.com/majority. That's texture.com/majority. Start your free trial today. Also, folks who have listened to this program for any extended period of time know that I have been a Blue Apron customer since, before they started advertising in this program. The Blue Apron meal this week was some type of like Chinese chicken salad that I had, and it was fantastic. And I was lucky because my daughter was not home, so I got to eat most of it. You can enjoy unforgettable meals inspired by the vibrant cooking of the Mediterranean, like seared salmon and spicy orange salsa, centered around fruits, veggies, lean meats, plenty of olive oil. These recipes are deliciously nutritious. We had fish tacos the other day. With incredible ingredients, chef-designed recipes, Blue Apron lets you see the power of what food can do. Blue Apron delivers farm-fresh ingredients, step-by-step recipes to your door. The menu changes every week based on what's in season and is designed by Blue Apron's in-house culinary team. They offer three plans: the two-person meal plan, the family meal plan, and the wine plan. I can tell you, folks, well, we get two family meals per week, and it's great. Home-cooked meal for certainly less than ordering in even Chinese, and great meals, food that I've never tried before. There's some stuff that I still, like when I think about it, there was some like Chinese noodle thing that I can't get out of my head. And that was, we have it like, I don't know, it comes back around every 3 or 4 months. keep saying I'm going to make it myself. I don't do it.
The man knows food, people.
There you go. You get, check out this week's menu and get your first three meals free at blueapron.com/majority. That's blueapron.com/majority. Get your first three meals free. Blue Apron. It's a better way to cook. And then, of course, after you've eaten, what are you going to do? You're going to brush your teeth. One of the things I've also noticed on some of these dating apps, dental hygiene, extremely important. And I have always now have a tremendous amount of confidence about this because I've been on my dental hygiene kick now for 2.5 years. And the fact is that most of you are brushing your teeth wrong. You're not doing it for long enough, and you don't change your brush properly. You got to change your brush every 3 months. But if you don't have an electric toothbrush, like I tell you this, my general practitioner doctor, I went for my annual, he's like, electric toothbrush? Yes, I do, of course. Most brands focus on selling flashy gimmicks rather than better brushing, but not Quip. Quip is an electric toothbrush that costs a fraction of the bulkier brushes and packs the right amount of vibrations to clean your teeth. The built-in timer, the guiding pulses, help you clean for the full dentist-recommended 2 minutes. Quip's subscription is built for your health. It delivers new brush heads every 3 months for just $5. That includes free shipping worldwide. Also comes with a suction mount that unsticks. You use it as a cover for travel. That's the thing that's amazing about Quip. It's the first electric toothbrush you can actually genuinely travel with. Everyone loves Quip. They were on Oprah's O list. They were named Time's Best Inventions. They were on the S Sam list, which I just came up with. It's the first subscription electric toothbrush accepted by the American Dental Association. They're even backed by a network of over 20,000 dentists and hygienists, hundreds of thousands of happy brushers. Quip starts at just $25, and if you go to getquip.com/majority right now, you'll get your first refill pack free with a Quip electric toothbrush. That's your first refill pack free at getquip.com/majority, spelled GETQUIP.com/majority. All right, we're going to take a quick break, and we're going to talk to Assad Haider about mistaken identity. Folks, just a reminder, this program relies on its members for its support. When you become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com, you get extra content every day, almost every day. I don't think tomorrow we're going to have that. And you get commercial-free listening, and you are supporting the show on a daily basis. JoinTheMajorityReport.com. All right, quick break. Right back with Assad Haider. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program the founding editor of Viewpoint Magazine, the author of Mistaken Identity, Race and Class in the Age of Trump, Assad Haider. Welcome to the program, Assad.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start with, I guess, the most obvious question. What do we mean when we say identity politics?
Well, that's a great question, and it's a very complicated one, because you find that everyone who uses the word brings a different meaning to it, and sometimes they bring two or three different meanings to it within the same think piece or declaration or whatever. So what I do basically in the book is look at two moments historically, and the first is in 1977 when the term really appears for the first time. And it's put forth by the Combahee River Collective, which is a group of radical black feminists who say that, look, we've been in coalitions, we've been working in social movements like the Black Liberation Movement, the feminist movement, and the labor movement, and we find that all of them are based on these exclusionary identities. In the feminist movement, there's an assumption that women are white. In the Black Liberation Movement, an assumption that black people are men. And in the labor movement, an assumption that workers are white males. And so their idea was that identity politics was about asserting their own identities as black women and organizing autonomously, and that by doing that, they could disrupt these kinds of exclusionary identities that had existed in these movements. And on that basis, they could engage in actual kind of coalition work, which would challenge all of the structures of oppression that characterize the society. So that was the origin point.
But let me just ask you, I'm sorry, before you go to the after the origin point, what was their theory that that would disrupt those existing groups that were exclusionary in nature?
Well, the idea was that these different forms of oppression, they say, are interlocking: racism, sexism, class. And so the fact that they were located at the kind of intersection of these different forms of oppression meant that if they were trying to overcome their own oppression, it would necessarily mean attacking all of the different forms of oppression that are experienced by other people. And so that's why they say famously in their statement that if black women become free, then everyone has to become free.
And is that a function because of where they're situated in society? Would the same argument be made for if white women became free?
Well, what they're coming out of is the experience in various feminist organizations in which white women, due to the fact that they weren't also subject to the relationships that come out of racism, they tended to be the leadership, they tended to represent what the movement's interests supposedly were, and they didn't always align with what the interests of black women were. And so in the feminist movement, there was this division, and they were trying to point that out.
No, but I guess what I'm saying is that it was that perspective that they had on identity politics, was it unique to where they were as black women, as black gay women situated? Like, we're the canaries. And if we're okay in the mine, then everybody will be okay in the mine.
I think it was really specific to their situation and their experience, and to their experience in political movements. I don't think, you know, that they meant something totally general about everybody's identity.
Okay. Okay.
They were talking really specifically about their experience, and that's because they were really thinking politically. They were thinking on the basis of their experience and movements and how they could move forward to build a more inclusive and radical movement.
Okay.
Yeah, so then I go from there to looking basically at the 2016 primaries, because that's a point at which the discussion of identity politics really resurges and enters into the mainstream. I mean, in the 80s and 90s, it was discussed in some ways, but usually sort of intra-left debates or academic debates. And at this point, we see it discussed on the news on a daily basis now. And now the meanings are really different. And I think it really arose as a response to the sort of challenge that social movements have made in the past few years to the status quo of liberal politics. And that became expressed within the political parties in the form of the Bernie Sanders campaign as a challenge to the kind of hegemony of the Democratic Party elites. And at that point, identity politics became a way of arguing against any form of politics that challenged economic inequality in this country. And so my book is looking at the instability of this term and how, on the one hand, at one point at its origins, it was about making a more radical, more inclusive kind of movement, and that now it becomes a source of division and of expelling one kind of political program.
So is it, I mean, in terms of its use, because I mean, I see it used in all quarters, right? And mm-hmm. I see it used both, I guess maybe the classic case relative to the campaign, and this actually happened after the campaign, was Jennifer Palmieri, who was the, I think she was the communications director for Clinton, and she was on, maybe it was Chuck Todd, saying that the, and I think it was about the Women's March, like, this is all, or came off of that, like, this is all about, there's this, there's no ideology involved in this. There's, it's just about, you know, I think she said, like, it's about identity. And
yeah, she said, in response to basically anti Trump protests, she said, look, you're wrong to look at these crowds and think this means everyone wants $15 an hour. Okay. Sort of referring to the Fight for 15 campaign. And she says, you know, these big crowds don't mean that we should move to the left. It's all about identity on our side now. So, I mean, that's a very, clear way that the language of identity was being used to challenge the idea that we could have a different kind of politics that really addresses economic inequality and addresses the fact that politicians serve ruling class interests. So it was specifically being mobilized against that. And it was being mobilized against, you know, the Fight for 15 campaign, which represents a lot of workers of color and is a major kind of movement about mobilizing against racism.
All right. So, I mean, and I think, like, you know, to me, that's a fairly, like, naked reinterpretation of something. Like, you know, we saw it with, a la, you know, the no labels movement, or the, you know, maybe even see it with, like, you know, the civility and stuff like that. But I see identity politics also used by the right. Usually in incoherent ways. But yet it is, you know, there's a best-selling author who is, you know, drawing crowds all around the country, arguing against, you know, identity politics. In some way, I'm not. Maybe you have a better sense of how he's using it than I do.
Are you talking about Jordan Peterson?
Yes.
Okay.
And we also, I think, there are folks on the left who use it in, I think, an equally sort of maybe somewhat disingenuous way too. Mm-hmm. Right? I mean, to mm-hmm. argue.
I agree.
And so we outline that so that we get a notion of, at the very least, like, all the ways, because it sounds like there is, you know, it's in the eyes of the mouths of the bespeakers, I guess.
Yeah. So, first of all, I'd say Jordan Peterson really represents a white male identity politics. So as much as he wants to disavow identity politics, he is a practitioner of it.
Right.
And the reason for that, and the reason it plays out the way it does, is that we've had social movements in this country that have, and, you know, internationally, that have challenged the idea of whiteness as being the intrinsic universal. They've challenged the idea that men are the people who are in charge, and that they've challenged that whiteness and masculinity are inherent natural traits. They've shown that these are socially constructed things. And so now it becomes necessary to explicitly argue for them, like, put your shoulders back, clean your room, that way you can become a man. Because now we know that there's no intrinsic meaning to that category. It's something that's socially and culturally constructed. And so that's what that kind of identity politics is doing, is taking the fact that this identity has been challenged and now trying to reassert it, to shore it up. That's what you find on the right. Now, on the left, I think sometimes there's some confusion just because of the instability of this term. But there are some people who make really misleading or abstract kind of claims about some category being universal. Sometimes on the left, it's class. Sometimes it's, like, in the case of liberals like Mark Lilla, it's citizenship. And they think that these things are something that unite everybody, and that they're like a basic foundation for politics, and that if you start to introduce these other categories like race or gender, you're going to introduce divisions, and that they won't they don't add anything. They don't add anything that wouldn't already be encompassed by getting everybody good citizenship rights, or by winning some kind of class equality. Well, I think that is mistaken because it's just putting things in the abstract. It's not looking at the way that society actually operates. It's not looking at the actual history. If you look at the actual history, you find that race is totally tied up with class, okay? That's what I've looked at in my book, and you could make the same argument with gender. I don't agree with the idea that they should both be subsumed into this unitary category of identity. They're different relations. But if you look at the history of the formation of American capitalism, of inequality in this country, you see that race and class are totally tied together. And that was something that the movements against racism of the 20th century, the civil rights movement, the Black Power movement, and so on, they fundamentally recognized this. And we should study those movements and take our lead from them.
All right, so is there anybody... Because so we have like three definitions of the way that identity politics are being used incorrectly. It strikes me. And mm-hmm. is there anybody or any movements that you see that are using it in the way that you are advocating or suggest that it's been used in the past?
Well, I don't necessarily advocate that. We should go back to the origins of the word because we don't control what words mean. They circulate and other people take them up. And even if the meaning is confused or distorts the original intention, it has real effects. And, right. In politics, the way you word things just has actual effects. And so I think that now identity politics has become a term that's really been appropriated by the neoliberal elite. And it carries that baggage with it every time you use it. And so I've argued that, we need to look at the history of where it came from and really understand how radical those intentions were, but then that we can carry those intentions on with a new language that might be more appropriate or that might have more of the effect that we want now based on how the terminology has changed and how the history has changed.
All right. I want to put a pin in that, to ask you what that new language will be in a bit. So to the extent that it's being wielded by, the way that identity politics are being wielded today, I mean, do you think that there is a practice of it? I mean, is there, and I keep, to me, it just reminds me, of the whole, like, no labels movement, which, seemed to have, there were a lot of people talking about it, but that was because they had the money and they were, sort of entrenched in the establishment. But there was a constituency of zero. And I wonder today when you look at the, for instance, like where would Black Lives Matter be, relative to the practice or the not practice of, it seems like a hazardous term to say identity politics, right?
Yeah.
I mean, because we could be talking about anything. But where are they situated in terms of their integrating, how do you perceive that movement, is really the question.
Yeah. Okay. So I don't think that I don't think that the Black Lives Matter movement can be reduced to identity politics in the way that it's used by someone like Palmieri. Okay, it's totally opposed to that. And I think that, every movement originates at a specific site, just like we said about the Columbia River Collective. It originated specifically within Black communities with a specific problem of police violence against Black people. And that is that was a totally important kind of movement to emerge. But its relevance went to a general level. It was a general kind of challenge to the existing structures of policing and of the prison system that we have in this country. And we see the general relevance of it now with the way that immigration policy is being militarized and immigrants are being policed and detained. I think we see how that goes beyond just something that's about one identity. It's something that opens up a practice of coalition so that you can challenge the oppression of everyone. And I think that the Black Lives Matter movement was an opening for that. And that's one of the really amazing things about it.
I mean, walk me through this because I can't quite I mean, I understand what you're saying. Again, this is sort of like that you know, canary in the coal mine theory, right? Is that because when we talk about the excesses of policing, folks in the African-American communities feel these impacts. I mean, do they feel it first, or do they feel it in a unique way that when addressed necessarily reforms the mechanisms more broadly speaking?
Well, like I said, every social movement, I mean, you know, we don't get at one stroke the transformation of the whole society. It's going to come from specific sites and points of origin, and it's going to have specific demands. There are waves of movements, and they can enter into coalition with each other. They can go move in a particular sequence. But the idea that I'm proposing is that they all need to add up eventually to a project of general emancipation, to a project of changing the whole society. And that I think that fundamentally that's what we saw happen with the civil rights movement and the Black Power movements. They opened up the possibility of all kinds of other movements emerging. The New Left, the anti-war movement, you know, sort of came about as a possibility because of that. And I think that, you know, recently we saw Occupy, Black Lives Matter, the Bernie Sanders campaign, which was, you know, to some extent a grassroots mobilization. We see these things happen in specific sites, and they take up specific targeted demands. The important thing is to be able to draw the connection between them so that they can build and become bigger and make real social transformation.
Who, I mean, when you say, like, are there examples of movements that have not done that? In other words, when I can't tell who the audience is when you say that they need to expand, or they do expand, or we need to perceive them and help them expand. I'm not sure. Like, is this a message or a theory for members of these specific movements, or people outside of these movements, or are there examples of these movements that you've seen that come together around an issue that is unique to their identity that does not have broader implications in terms of, like, broader emancipation, or I think you call it universal
insurgent universality. Yeah. So, I mean, one thing is that I don't want to talk about movements as monolithic entities. You know, in all kinds of different movements, we see these different political languages being used, and one of them is an identity kind of language, and there are also other languages. And I think that one of the frustrations I've had as a participant in social movements, anti-austerity movements in California, which I talk about in the book, is that instead of race, for example, becoming a factor that adds and builds on the campaign as it exists and makes it stronger because it's targeting more of the social structure that we're up against, often it became a source of division and mistrust, and it undermined coalitions. And often that was attached to a language of identity or to the kinds of terminology that go along with identity politics today. And so what my audience is people who are involved in politics who are uncertain about this language, uncertain about how to address issues of race, people of color in socialist movements and labor movements who are frustrated by a leadership or a membership that doesn't take the issues of race seriously. I'm speaking to all of these people, and that's why I place such an emphasis in the book on these movements in the past, the anti-racist movements in the past that saw race and class as inseparable and worked on both lines.
So, I mean, walk us through that in a more tangible way, and it's centered in some respects around the notion of white privilege in the context of these anti-austerity movements.
You mean the experience?
Yes.
Of identity. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, so for example, there are the ideas that an economic issue is a white issue. Okay. That opposing austerity was a white issue and it didn't represent the interests of people of color. That's something that was actually said in these anti-austerity movements. Well, I mean, it's an absurdity because actually a huge portion of the population that's hurt by austerity at every level are people of color. Just like we were pointing out about Palmieri, I mean, she was intentionally kind of dismissing the Fight for 15 movement by invoking identity and ignoring the fact that so many of the people who are participants in that movement and who would see a serious change in their standard of living were people of color. So that was one reductive kind of understanding of identity that really made it impossible to talk about what kinds of demands we would put forward. The demands then, you know, we would have endless like 7-hour meetings in which people are talking about, have we included everything in this list, rather than saying, you know, some demands represent all of us in different ways and we can make strategic decisions about what to put forward. Instead, it became a moral discussion about, well, if you left this group out, are you claiming to speak for this group, et cetera. And that language, I think, doesn't actually serve the cause of fighting racism effectively.
But, I mean, if we're talking in the context of an austerity movement, right, or anti-austerity movement, isn't the dilemma in some respects that in one way we can say, okay, if we reform the carceral state and policing in such a way that black people are not subject to being policed by police in the way that they are, as opposed to, in many respects, white people, right? And that the theory that if in pursuit of justice for black people in respect to the police and the carceral state, that it's going to reform it for everybody. How does an anti-austerity movement have that same ability to fix things for people who are black, let's say, because maybe there's not going to be the rollback in education spending and in a successful anti-austerity move. Maybe there's going to be more investment, broadly speaking, in infrastructure and whatnot. But the way that that money gets doled out is still subject. Even if I could show you on paper the austerity has been defeated, that more money is being spent, that there are no cutbacks, the reality is the way that those expenditures are doled out, the lived experience of people who may get some relief from the rollback in austerity measures is still unaddressed. Right. Like they're still putting there's still lead in my water, or there's still, the money was not necessarily distributed to me because I don't have the political, the political representation that maybe white people do in that city or state or whatever. I mean, that's
absolutely true. And that's why, fighting against racial disparities also has to be a part of an anti-austerity movement, but it cuts both ways. Because if you fight against racial disparities without addressing economic inequality, then you get a situation in which elite members of a particular marginalized community have their interests served, but the masses of people who are in that community get left behind. And a lot of that has happened since the 1970s in communities of color. And so this is really a question of you have to address this problem in both directions.
I mean, yeah. Talk a little bit about those examples, because you have some examples of that in your book. And in some respects, it reminds me of a joke that Marc Maron told back when we were at Air America in the roll up to the 2008 election, that the black people are going to have this historic opportunity to be screwed over by one of their own or something to that effect. And in some respects, that's sort of a dynamic that has played out.
Right. Obama, the fact that Black Lives Matter arose during the Obama years gives you an illustration of how the fact that when you get the rise of a political elite, you know, it was a huge turning point to have a black president, but the fact that a black individual from the political elite became a president did not change the fact that most people who were living in black working class communities were dealing with constant, the constant practically military occupation by the police force. And so that's, you know, a recent example. This is part of sort of a general historical trend, which is the result of the fact that after the civil rights movement achieved its major legislative victories, it was possible for black elites to enter into the mainstream of the American society, to become mayor, to become become a businessman, and so on. And that led to a very complicated situation, because there was a time when the interests of the elites and of the masses of black people were aligned, because they were all excluded from society on the basis of formal legal structures. When that went away, the possibility of the elites rising up in society and leaving the communities behind became really pronounced. And that led to a lot of disillusionment. I talk about, for example, the poet and political leader Amiri Baraka, who, as a black nationalist, worked for the election of Kenneth Gibson as mayor of Newark, and found that when Gibson was actually mayor, he was doing things that were not in the interests of the constituency that brought him to power. And so that's why Baraka made this conversion from black nationalism to Marxism.
And is it possible, however, that we need to go through that process? I mean, to get to that point, that it we need to, that there has been a necessity to deal with that sort of one-dimensional issues. I mean, because you say, like, you know, black working class folk dealing with policing, but it's not just black working class folk who deal with this, right? I mean, you drive a nice car in L.A., and that you're going to get pulled over. You're a professor at Harvard, and you're trying to get into your house, and maybe the cops come in. I mean, so it's not limited to that. That is it conceivable? I don't know if I really believe this, but in terms of just playing devil's advocate, that there needs to be a full integration of elites into this, and then there is a natural progression to understand that, like, once the deck has been cleared, I don't know if you can fully clear it, but certainly we've made progress on some level, right? And and certainly by the end of the Obama administration, you had the DOJ very aggressively going into police departments in a way that they had not in 25 years, 30 years maybe. That we need to that is a first order issue, and that class in some ways cannot be fully addressed in these instances until those issues are resolved?
Well, I would put it a different way, and you kind of illustrated it, that, you know, elites, they don't make change. Elites ride the wave of mass movements. And fundamentally, in terms of change in this country around race, the civil rights movement was one of the most significant mass movements of the 20th century. The Black Power movement continued this mass movement in a different way. And elites emerged from these movements, and they emerged and they achieved policy changes because there were thousands of people committing acts of civil disobedience and out in the streets. And so that's something that has to be understood, that this distinction between mass movements and political elites, elite leadership. And when you talk about that kind of distinction, class really does come into play, because elites belong to a different class, and they may, if it so happens that you get to a point where they turn against the interests of the movement that put them where they are, then those movements' aims will not be realized. So yes, elites are still subject to racism, but that can only continue to be challenged if there is a mass movement and that they are subject to the criticism and the supervision of these mass movements. Otherwise, they're going to climb up and leave everybody else behind.
Are there instances where racial experiences should be first order issues?
Absolutely. Let's say that my perspective is let's say that I'm in a socialist organization. In some cases, one particular issue is going to take precedence above all others because that's strategically what's relevant for that particular political situation. You can't fight on every front at once. You have to make choices and you have to have a sequence and build things. And so in certain situations, a socialist organization too should put race first when it's the relevant thing to do. For example, if we had had the DSA has grown massively since the election. If it had been of that size at the beginning of Black Lives Matter, its priority should have been to participate in that and to provide all the support that was possible, because in that political situation, I think that was the most pressing thing. Fundamentally, this is a question of political strategy. It's not a question that can be decided in the abstract. It's something that has to be determined in the situation.
And so let's talk just about that new language that you suggest that we need to talk about this dynamic. What is that new language?
That new language is going to come from actual practice, because right now we're seeing that identity politics as a term is causing confusion, not clarity. It's bringing, it's in some ways it brings the baggage of this neoliberal kind of conception, and in other ways it just means that people don't understand what the other person is talking about. So I think that in movements we've got to find a way to make sure that we're not setting up abstract oppositions between empty kind of abstract categories like race, class, and gender, but we're really looking at specific situations. And we're really trying to not establish hierarchies between what we do, but respond strategically to given situations. The language is going to come out of that. It's not something that I'm going to dictate.
I mean, it's fascinating because I feel like the only people who use identity politics are people who critique what their definition of identity politics is. Like, I've never heard anybody saying, I guess Jennifer Palmieri, but she was really using it as a way of that was almost laughable, rhetoric in a way. And, I rarely.
I think it's pretty new. Yeah, it's pretty new. I mean, it used to be that in the 90s, there was a huge left debate around it, sort of sparked by Todd Gitlin. It was generally used in a derogatory fashion. But that wasn't the case in the 80s. And I think now, starting with 2016, it started to be used in a positive way, which was really surprising. Palmieri was sort of an example of that. But I've heard it in other contexts. You see it used in think pieces all the time. There are all kinds of think pieces that say, here's why the left needs identity politics. Here's why the Democratic Party can't abandon identity politics. Well, what do they mean by that? I mean, each one you read is going to say something different.
Right. And, but are they expressing something that is fundamentally different from what you're saying? That, aside from obviously some of those people don't have necessarily the same political program that you have. When it comes to, outcomes, some of them aren't interested in, more socialism, let's say. But within that context, when they ultimately define it, aren't they talking about not that the idea of groups should be or individuals who share characteristics that are a function, and I think you describe this as as being problematic, that people define their associations within these practice of identity politics as a function of the oppression that they get, right? And that you feel that has limitations. I mean, just speak to that for a moment, because it seems to me that most of those people who express that, I think, aren't necessarily saying that we should exclude class politics, just that in a given context, it's not the first order issue.
Well, I mean, first of all, I would say that for many years, because of the specific kind of politics that we have in the U.S., class politics has actually been seriously neglected in the past several years. I mean, in the past couple decades, at least. And that's something that it's urgent to change that. And if you use the language of identity politics to say that class politics is overemphasized, you're living on a different planet from me, because I see extreme polarization of wealth in this country, and I see a left that is frequently unwilling to address that or tackle it directly. So that would be one point I would make. Second, fundamentally, part of my criticism of identity politics is that when you define politics in terms of an identity group, however you want to produce that identity group, then politics becomes all about demanding recognition from the state. And you define that identity in terms of some kind of injury that you've received on the basis of your identity, and you demand that the state protect you. Okay, this is a politics which comes out of victimhood. And now I'm not saying that victims should pull themselves up by their bootstraps, or that the victimization isn't real. What I'm saying is that we shouldn't accept that logic, which says that all we can do politically is ask for protection from the state. We shouldn't just conceive of ourselves as victims, but as active agents in making politics and in making change. And that can be something which is about fighting racism. It's not setting up an opposition between race and class. It's about setting up an opposition between the kind of politics that is stuck in that kind of asking elites for change, or the kind of politics which is about organizing ourselves.
Assad Haider, the book is Mistaken Identity, Race and Class in the Age of Trump. Thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right, folks. Going to take a quick break and head into the fun half in a moment, wherein we will take your phone calls and IMs. I want to read this one email, because this came up in the fun half a couple of days ago. We had a gentleman call in who was very upset about a video that we did about a year ago when a younger man called in. And his name was, what was it, Scott Connor, or the guy from Terminator called in. And you know, wanted to further the argument that had been gaining a lot of traction because of Sam Harris platforming Charles Murray again about IQ. And this older gentleman said there were 51 or 52 scientists who came out with a letter that said that they supported some findings in
the bell curve.
In the bell
probably
curve.
Probably the non-controversial ones.
Very possibly, right? But who knows? It was suggested to him that to the extent that IQ shows anything, it's clear that in the same way, if you you plant two seeds, they will reach their potential. You can only measure them reaching their potential if they are similarly situated in terms of environmental impact, how much water they get, how much sun they get, how much are they subjected to toxins, et cetera, et cetera. And it was argued that people weren't dramatically different in terms of that metaphor. Well, I received an email from Patrick, who is from Utah. Don't know how much he wants me to reveal. I'm responding to a caller who attempted to assert that certain races were of lower intelligence. I am a board-certified neuropsychologist, and I have literally given thousands of IQ tests over the last three decades. So, I don't know. Take it for what you want. I mean, a guy who's given thousands of IQ tests over the last three decades, who's certified by a board of neuropsychology, Or that dude who called in and remembered that 51 scientists had sent a letter. Everyone who is properly trained in IQ testing is aware that IQ tests have strong cultural biases that can affect results. Specifically, IQ tests are designed to determine how well someone is functioning within a particular environment. I'm giving you a link to a great video showing an Australian psychologist who devised an IQ test for Aboriginal children who typically score lower on IQ tests than white Australian children. She realized that children growing up in the outback environment required them to identify natural objects, shape, and locations in order to survive. She therefore devised an IQ test where children were required to identify the correct order and orientation of nondescript rocks. She found that white Australian children raised in a city scored in the mentally impaired range of functioning on the test when compared to Aboriginal children, which is not surprising based upon the research that looks at the impact of culture upon IQ scores. The differences in IQ between races, as described in the bell curve, simply suggest that African-American children in those studies were not properly prepared for the environment that the IQ test was evaluating. The main clinical purpose for IQ testing is to identify children who need additional support and interventions. And then he include the link, which we'll put up there.
Yeah, send it over.
But the point being that not only is intelligence in and of itself, if you could measure that in a vacuum, a function of environmental factors and not just physical environmental factors, but all sorts of environmental factors, that we don't have really a way of testing intelligence in a vacuum, that it is all contextualized as to what specific things we're testing it against. Like, you know, in a soccer game, it is you measure how many goals a team got. You don't measure how many touchdowns. You can't. It's not relevant. You have to have a maybe you don't have to, but when you attempt to exert a specific measure for intelligence, it is contextualized in and of itself. It's narrowly defined. City kids don't know as much about farm animals as kids who live on a farm. Kids who live on a farm don't know as much about subways or, you know, sidewalks.
Maybe Michael Jordan was making a roundabout point about this when he went to prove whether he could play baseball as good just automatically as he played basketball.
There you go.
They also did, Michael did a great episode of his show about this, and I forget who we had on. Was it a scientist?
Yeah, we talked about that dude, and it was his theory his name escapes me for the moment, but
Turkheimer.
Turkheimer, whose theory that essentially, you know, you can measure the IQ of people who do not have the same essentially environmental detriment, did not grow up with the same environmental obstacles. That genetics play a larger part if you if that tree can grow in an environment that is not in any way an obstacle to its growing. Not too dry, not too wet, not too toxic.
Yeah, and he also debunked the idea that IQ is a static trait in a person. And actually what he found out was that the most increase in IQ, like if you test rich children like a few years apart, their IQ doesn't change that much no matter what you do. If you do the same thing for poor children, you can see a lot more of an increase in their IQ scores, which, you know, from that it follows that that's where the resources should be put because that's where they can make a difference.
Right. And a lot of this is so obvious if you know anything about like schooling kids and how certain kids fall behind during the summer months when they aren't around like schooling and stuff like that. It's the same thing. It's so obvious.
In fact, after the break, we'll talk about this Bill and Melinda Gates study. They commissioned a 500-page report that basically said their whole $700 million program of teacher evaluations of was an oops. What are you going to do? But it's not just a question of the wasting of their money, which has been a problem. It's that so much resources has been involved in fighting the corporate school reform movement that it is it's stunning. We'll talk a little bit more about that after the break. Folks, don't forget, you can join us in the break by becoming a member of the Majority Report at jointhemajorityreport.com. Just pennies. I mean, it's a lot of pennies, but a day. But if you have that many pennies, we're doing you a favor. Let's put it that way. Jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, a reminder, you can access Jamie's program, The Antifada, at patreon.com/TheAntifada or on iTunes. This week, part two.
Yeah. If you liked that interview that Sam just did with Assad Haider, we talk about a lot of the same things in this two-part episode with my comrade Justin Charles from the North Brooklyn DSA and the DSA Afro-Socialist and Socialists of Color Caucus.
There you go.
We also just recorded a collaborative episode with Brett from Crossover. Left Radio.
Crossover.
Crossover episode
is what we call those in the biz. Crossover.
Thank you. That's the word I was looking for.
Matt, no crossover for you, but...
Cross medium.
Look at you. Look at you.
You want to cut to that, Jamie?
Of course.
Matt has some...
Literary Hangovers available on YouTube now.
Oh, look at that.
Some people said that they're smart TVs. They just like to watch things on YouTube.
Yeah. Should I be doing that?
A lot of vocal fry going on there, I got to say.
Yeah.
I picked up on a lot of vocal fry on your part.
That's good.
You're much more vocal fry on...
It's a bit more casual.
Oh, you listen to Matt's podcast?
I listen to it on YouTube.
All right.
There you go. Well, you got to get yours on YouTube. That's where everybody...
All right. I guess I will.
Sam's a YouTube star.
I'm totally on the YouTube all the time. I don't even. All right, we're going to take a quick break. Don't forget. What is the story with the TMBS tomorrow night? No, yeah.
Oh, we're doing. There's going to be just a audio only with Harvey K talking about Thomas Paine, the legacy of Thomas Paine.
There you go. So. Check it out, Michael Brooks Show on iTunes and anywhere your fine podcasts are sold. Quick break, then into the fun half.